and welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee, and I'm joined today by Josh Edgren.
Yes, I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho, and delighted to be here today. Jameson, what delicious set of delicacies have you cooked up for us today? What's the prompt? What's the topic? What are we doing?
Well, today we wanted to do another Dadcraft episode, thinking through specifically what discipline looks like when you're not at home. These are two very different things in some sense, and yet there's a lot of overlap. There should be a lot of overlap. If it doesn't look very similar, then there are some problems there maybe, but we'll maybe come back to discipline. We talked a little bit in the prophet, priest, king sections, maybe particularly the priest episode, when we talked about the dad's priestly work, protecting his household from sin, protecting his children from sin, and walking through repentance and restoration and fellowship. But that necessarily is more challenging when you're not at home, when you're not, you know, within the private confines of your home, and there are external pressures around you. So that could be any number of pressures. That could be time, like you're trying to get somewhere on time. That could be other people you're with and maybe the public embarrassment that now this discipline episode is bringing to your family. That could be just trying to get a task done and you don't want to stop and interrupt the grocery run and figure all of that out because your kid has just disobeyed you in the middle of Home Depot or Walmart and you've got to sort out, what do I do? How do I handle this? And so we'll talk through some specifics, but just more generally, we wanted to work through how can you set yourself and your children up for success when you're out in public, essentially. And that could be public like the store. That could also just be at another family's house. You might not think of that as public, but you're still out of your kind of normal domain. So the first question I wanted to just start with, and maybe a passage of scripture to read here in answer, is why should you be concerned about this? Do you really need to discipline your kids on the go when you're out in public, when you're doing these things? Can you just put it off and wait till later? I mean, they're going to sin again, so you can correct that behavior in another time and, you know, better luck next time. Or do you need to discipline them in some form or fashion when this comes up? Because it inevitably will. And I think the first place I go to when thinking about discipline on the go is the Shema in Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy 6, starting in verse 4 and then continuing on, I'm just going to read a smaller section of that, is the Hebrew Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." So after that, God says this, he gives this instruction, "These words that I command you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." So really what God is getting at here in giving this command to Israel is that you're to be instructing your children always throughout all of their lives with you as children in your household, that you're to be preparing them and teaching them to obey God's law every step of the way. So it's not really an option to just say, well, we can do the discipline thing at home and then ignore sin out in public. He's saying, when you walk by the way, when you're driving to Walmart, when you're at church in the lobby or wherever you are, you need to be instructing your children in the Lord. And part of that means restoring them back into fellowship through discipline.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point to keep in mind. We often think of discipline as simply correction, when discipline really is a much bigger and broader thing related to all the training and instruction you give your children. The difference being that what we often refer to as discipline, which maybe we should say correction, is instruction, you know, with a painful component, right? Instruction with a wooden spoon, as opposed to instruction on just, you know, factual things about how the world is, or wisdom things about how the world works. So I love that you've connected this topic to the Shema and the instructions surrounding it, because it's so important to remember this is just part of teaching your children what the world is and how they honor God. And we don't stop teaching our children what the world is and how to honor God just because you've left the four walls of your home. You continue that teaching. You continue that authoritative interpretation of the world no matter where you are. And that necessarily involves instructing them about the consequences for sin and maintaining proper discipline, maintaining proper behavioral standards, teaching them about propriety, teaching them about manners, politeness, you know, love in trifles. All of that is in direct continuity with what you do at home. So that I love that. And then secondly, another answer to your question of why discipline on the go, maybe slightly shifting from what I just said, but there is a discontinuity between discipline at home and discipline out in public. And it's almost like the difference between practice and game time, right? In a lot of ways, you've been practicing for this, and now it's put to the test. So maybe, you know, review and testing or studying and testing is a better comparison. But when you take your kids out, especially if you have a bunch of little ones, there's this sort of like, yeah, it's the same feeling you get when you're about to take a test. You're like, all right, wonder how much I know. I wonder how we're going to do. Like, and this is side topic. I argue this is a huge benefit to having your kids in church and also to having everyone's kids in church. It's like a weekly pop quiz on the whole work of training your children in righteousness. Like every week I go and I have a pop quiz, right? How'd we do this week, right? And it's not like a pass-fail thing, but it's also like, okay, I didn't do so hot. Or we're in the middle of, you know, just trying circumstances. Guess what? My kids are 2 and 3 respectively, right? So we took them out and we spanked them. We brought them back in. And we'll get into that more as we go. But the idea that that there's continuity between what you're doing, disciplining at home and disciplining out of the home. But also there is a difference in that, okay, now's the testing point. How are we doing?
I think that's exactly right. The practice and game kind of metaphor is perfect because when your children are in your home just the whole first 18 years or so of their lives, in some sense, that's all practice. That's all them getting direct input from the coach on how to live well, how to live a godly life. And your discipline is only one small part of that. It's an essential part, but it's one part of a greater picture, which is that you're preparing your children for the rest of their lives and eventually how to hopefully raise their own children and walk in their own marriage and walk faithfully in their own church if they move away and they've, you know, covenanted together with another body of believers. You want them to be taking what they got from you and your household and investing that now in this new community and these new people. And so we're really, I think, helping them as well to connect the dots that discipline or these standards, whatever the standards are for your kids, they're not just what my parents want me to do at home. They're teaching me how to live no matter where I am and no matter who I'm with. And there's, in fact, some greater responsibility when I'm with other people, when I'm with people outside of our family, because look, you can have your kids seemingly at each other's throats and walk them through discipline and restoration. And within 30, 45 seconds, they could be happy as clams and playing together again, right? And laughing it all off and just continuing in fellowship. That's harder when your kid sins against someone else's kid who they don't know that well. It's not as easy for them to get back in fellowship. And so the stakes are higher in that sense of just like you want to train them to, in some sense, like quote unquote, be on your best behavior, right? Why? Because in some ways the offense can cause greater damage more quickly with people who are not bound together. Like I have to reconcile with my brother. He's here all the time. I don't have to reconcile with this other person because I only see them once a week or two, you know? So there's maybe that aspect in play that just the stakes are higher out in public. But I also want to really quickly, before we get into some principles, and we can go into the practical very quickly here, I want to say on the negative side, like why not just wait until you get home, right? Junior disobeys you at the grocery store or in the car or whatever. Why not just wait and talk about that when you get home? And maybe this is obvious, but particularly with little kids, I think you run a risk of the kid just forgetting that that happened. And then they're shocked when you're coming to talk to them and spank them for something that they did an hour ago or 30 minutes ago that is not even present in their mind. So discipline coming in the moment is very important, especially the younger the child is. And there may be, you know, there may be a place with older kids as they grow and can hold those things more closely that you have a follow-up at home or greater consequence at home, perhaps, or something like that. But especially with little kids, you want to address those things as close to the inciting incident as possible. But then also, you already alluded to this, there's just a spiritual reality at play here, which is that the kid's not in fellowship anymore with someone, whether that's with God or with you or with other kids or whatever, with the person who's waiting on your table at a restaurant, right? Whatever it is, they're not in fellowship with someone, and you need to teach them to restore that fellowship, right? If they say something rude to a stranger in public, teach them how to reconcile and apologize and, you know, those sorts of things. Because when you wait until you get home, well, okay, that situation has already passed and they never were restored. Fellowship wasn't regained in that moment, which is just something that you don't want your kid to have to live through as much as possible. You want them to be restored.
That goes back to the priest thing, father as priest. Like, if you're letting your kid just be out of fellowship, then you just have this big stinky cloud. Like, you have this sin just kind of lingering about. It's your job to get rid of it. Make it right. Teach him how to make it right. One thing also I'd like to point out regarding why, and I guess we should acknowledge, as you kind of already have, there is a reluctance to it. It's difficult to maintain the same standards of behavior, the same standards of discipline outside of the home as inside. And so there's this obstacle that you're pushing against. Things are out of the ordinary. Things are out of normal. But that's actually a huge reason to maintain discipline standards. Because as soon as you leave your home, you're encountering all sorts of different standards, all sorts of different worlds, really. And you're bringing your little world into collision with all those other worlds. And some of them are great. Like, some of them are, you know, sweet families from church whose standards are very, very similar to yours. But even in those cases, they're different worlds. And so-and-so's family does things a little differently than we do. And you are, as soon as you step out of your little domicile, your kids are all looking at you like, all right, huh, what happens now? You know, are the rules the same here or are they different? Like, what is this thing? And in some ways, I don't want to get weird about it, but in some ways, you're bringing your family culture to war with all the other cultures. And you want to be able to have your family culture stand up against all of those other ones. Because otherwise, what are you doing? Like, if yours can't, or you're wimpy and it won't, well, then, you know, that just invalidates all the work you've been doing at home, right? To try to build something, to try to build a household that'll stand, right, against the world, the flesh, and the devil. So when you're out there and your kid and the other kid are involved in something, and, you know, it's clearly fine with little Johnny's parents what he's doing, but you look like, oh, that's no bueno. And then, you know, your little Jimmy looks back at you and goes, you know, what do you say? Like, is this a thing? Are we allowed to do this? And there's this pressure to go, yeah, it's fine, you know, whatever, because I don't want to make a stink with Johnny's parents. But if you do that, then you're folding and you're saying, you know, the rules that I gave you as God's representative to you to help you understand what the world is and how it works, those don't apply in circumstances where it would be awkward. Those only apply in circumstances where it's easy. And you've just told them, basically, that none of it matters.
And one thing on that note is that this is maybe particularly hard in instances that you're describing when you have something that little Johnny is doing from this other family, and it's not sin, it's not wrong per se, but it's a boundary that they have not drawn. And this could be something like running backwards up the slide or whatever, you know, at the playground. It could be a simple thing like that. And you've trained your kids and taught them, we don't do this thing. That's when it's really hard, because it might be exposing in you, I have held them to a standard that maybe actually doesn't matter and that I could just change. And that might be true, and you might change it later and teach your kids that it's okay with discernment to run up the slide backwards later. But that should happen later and not in the moment when they, because what they're going to see is, well, this is okay, not because my dad came to a principled stance that actually he wanted to loosen up around this particular thing or that I'm mature enough to do this now. It changed because, well, this other kid's doing it. And so what are you teaching them? You're teaching them that I can push boundaries when my friends are pushing boundaries because that might get my dad to change. You want the communication to be clear, even if you see a parent doing something differently and it inspires you to change in a good way. I want to sit down and talk with my kids about that and make sure they understand, hey, you know, I was watching this today, for instance. You might, you know, tell a little kid, I was watching this today, and I think you could do that. I think you could run up the slide like Johnny did and have wisdom and discernment not to do that in a way that's going to get somebody else hurt or be frustrating or angering to other kids because you're not letting them go down. You know, so let's talk about that. And then you set them off to do it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And there needs to be humility on the parts of dads to be like, ah, yeah, that actually, that standard that I thought made perfect sense actually was kind of arbitrary. And, huh, I don't really need to fight that fight. All right. So taking your kids out and having them engage with other families is useful to that end. This is somewhat tangentially related, but I don't know. Maybe there won't be a good time to say it for a while, so I'm going to say it now. You also need, I think strongly that this is true, you need to set up opportunities where your kids are not going to do what their friends are going to do, right? And you need to set that up and fight those battles, so to speak, early, where they're forced to choose, like, okay, do I submit to my parents and our family culture, or do I go off and do what my friends are going to do? And because if you never do that, the stakes just get higher and higher and higher until now we're talking about big life-altering things and huge cultural differences, and you've never stood up to their friends, right? And so, at the risk of seeming tyrannical, I do sometimes pick things that are perfectly harmless, but that I can tell my children, especially my daughters, want to do just because all their friends are doing it. And I say, nope, we're not doing that. Because I want to fight those battles now and set up this expectation that, no, we don't do things just because all of our friends are doing them. And that's super important. And also, similar thing, you need to be able to tell your daughters what to wear and what not to wear. And you want to fight those battles when they're 5 and not when they're 15. And so setting that up, I don't care that everyone else is wearing it. We're doing it. You are in submission to your mother and I on this subject. And we're just going to need to learn that now so that we'll all be happy later.
Yeah, those battles only get harder the longer your kids aren't forced to fight them. And not just harder for you, but harder for them. It's harder for them to succeed and to show loyalty and submission to their parents if you're not pressing them at an early age to submit and to follow your guidance and to follow your instruction and to learn to love it and to learn that it's a good thing. So this is where you talk about, you don't want to sound like a tyrant. You don't want to become a tyrant either. These are choice battles that you fight sometimes with certain things. In general, you should want your kids to love being with their friends because they get to play together. You don't want the play date to turn into, oh man, we're going to so-and-so's house, and that means they're going to get to do 20 different things that I can't do. You don't want their friends to think that way about them coming over either. Like, oh, when little Jimmy gets here, we're going to have to stop doing all the fun things because his dad doesn't let him do anything fun. Right? You've got to pick the battles carefully and with wisdom. And that's going to look different. It's not even like we can tell you, here's a list of the things you should do. The clothing one was a good one. The dressing is a good one. And there are maybe some other similar things like that that you just need to hold firm lines on. But there are some things that you might choose that are relatively arbitrary, and that's okay. And just like we've talked before, jumping on couches, like you have in your house jumping couches and non-jumping couches. Other people say no jumping couches. Other people say all the jumping couches. It just depends on your family culture and what standards you're going to set and which things you're going to choose. It's like with a toddler, having, we've talked about this as well, having little things like one or two things that they know they're not allowed to do as soon as they start to crawl. And they can't even talk yet, but they know one or two things, these are off limits. It doesn't matter what those things are. The point is not that the thing is bad for them. In fact, if it's something like bleach, maybe don't make that the thing. Like, put that away from them where they can't get into it for their own safety. But it could be as simple as don't touch the books on this shelf, and you leave them down there because, you know, look, if they chew up the books, you can replace them. That's not a big deal. That's not the point. The point is you want them to have an opportunity to succeed in obedience and to learn obedience, which is just so, so helpful when you think about going out of your own home in those terms. I want to look for some opportunities to kind of test my children in a positive way, to give them the opportunity to choose loyalty to the family rather than loyalty to friends or the influence of the people around them.
That's a great way of phrasing it. And then again, like you said, just reiterating, the point is not that your family culture is the be-all, end-all. That's not the point. The point is godliness in Christ Jesus, right? And works of righteousness. But the way God has set up the world is he's given us these little people, and he's given them to us to train up. And this means that we need to have certain foundations in order so that we can do that effectively, so that we can train them, right? To love his law. So we're not training them to love our law because our law is the be-all, end-all. We're training them to love our law so that they can love his law. You know, and I try to tell my kids this all the time and remind myself, you don't obey me because I said so. You obey me because God said so. And at some point, I'm going to be out of the way and you're going to obey him directly. So connecting this back to discipline on the go, which I realize we've strayed a little far from, the point maybe that connects these is, in all things, think about your children as what they are becoming. And what battles am I fighting now so that I won't have to fight them later? So that instead of fighting, you know, the submit to my authority battle when they're 15, instead, I have that as a foundation so that then I can say, you know, daughter, wear whatever you want, but here is wisdom, right? Or you know, son, go off and play with those friends. Absolutely, right? Go for it. But here is wisdom. And I know that they've got the law in their hearts so that they can then apply it. And that's what I want to see.
That's right. And to that end, it's fitting to spend some time talking about generic principles of discipline, because those still apply when you're on the go, right? You still need to be thinking about the bigger picture. You're not just thinking, in fact, maybe it's more important to emphasize this. When you're disciplining on the go, it's not because you are ashamed that your children are acting up in the middle of the grocery store or the restaurant or whatever. You might be ashamed. How could you think that this was acceptable? It's totally unacceptable behavior. And you might be right, but that's not the reason, importantly, that you're disciplining them. You're disciplining them because it is good for their souls and because it is training them in what's not shameful. It's training them in what is godly and what will be honored and celebrated and rewarded by God. So you don't want to go into it with the wrong motives, like, oh, you're embarrassing me right now, and so I'm going to give you a spanking, or you're embarrassing me right now, and so, whatever the consequence is that comes. That's just something to maybe guard your own heart against. Again, the stakes are higher, not just for them, but for you. So let's maybe go through some basic principles, and then before we do that, maybe I'll outline a few scenarios I've thought of that, you know, this might apply to. When we say discipline on the go, what do we mean? We've mentioned some. I think at church is a big one, in the car, in the grocery store or restaurant or whatever kind of public storefront you want to put into there. In the doctor's office would be a kind of analogous example. One that you may not think of as much is being out of town with family. So going and being on vacation by yourselves, like at a hotel or something at the beach, that's going to be a different kind of dynamic than your family is used to. It's going to create new kinds of temptations that you don't necessarily anticipate. But then the corollary to that is vacationing with family, like going to see brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents. There are going to be new temptations that get brought in because you're kind of at home. Like, one of you is maybe in the house that you grew up in, so it feels very natural and familiar. And yet, you're also not at home. It's new for your kids. It's unique for them. So those are some, there are plenty of other situations where discipline on the go applies and is important. But those are some of the categories that we're thinking in, right, in general. So the first principle that I thought of as I was writing down some notes was just, like I said, all the normal disciplinary principles apply. So that means we're disciplining for the child's sake, not for our sake. We're seeking to restore. We're not seeking to punish. Discipline is inherently restorative. It seeks to bring them back into fellowship. You need to be teaching them to repent. You need to be teaching them to pray still. And that might look slightly different, particularly if you have a longer discipline ritual at home. You might expedite that in some ways. But it's important that there are still those components of confession of sin, forgiveness of sin, restoration of fellowship. Those things have to be happening, even when you're out and about in some way. Anything to add there about the basic kind of principles of discipline traveling with you?
Yeah, no, that's right. And again, emphasizing the continuity between what you do at home and what you do out of the home. This is the same world, and you need to be able to teach them that by how you act. But just highlighting what you said before, everything's heightened. So you're... the stakes are higher in some respects. There's more on the line. Also, you are far more likely to have your passions rise because you're embarrassed, because this reflects poorly upon you. And maybe one thing I would add there is just inevitably there are eyes on you. Any athlete in a game can flub something, right? Can drop a pass, can, miss... miss a goal, whatever, miss a shot. You can't miss a goal. But the far greater test of his character is not that he misses, but what he does with the miss, right? So sure, if your kid disobeys you in public, like that's no bueno, and probably represents some failure of you along the way, although maybe he's just two, there's that too. But then, okay, how do you deal with this, right? Okay, there's the mess. Are you going to mope about it? Are you going to get all embarrassed and flustered and mad about it? No, you're going to go get your mop. You're going to clean it up just like you would at home. Nothing's different. So keep calm. Get your ego out of the picture. Just deal with the mess.
Yeah, ego is a huge thing. Just in protecting your kids against your own ego in executing godly discipline is so important, whether you're at home or not. The one thing that I want to come back to and emphasize from the normal principles of discipline is we've mentioned at home, you want to try to find a private place as much as possible. That's especially true, I think, in public. There might be some form of verbal correction or rebuke that comes in front of everyone, and that should be measured and not you flying off the cuff and getting heated and losing your temper and yelling at your kids. That's even more inappropriate in some sense in public than it would be at home. It should bring you shame if you lose your temper in that way in front of others, even more so than it would just a run-of-the-mill occasion of that at home. But you want to try to then, after the correction, like you can say, that was clearly disobedience. Come on, we're going to go and talk about this. And you want to try to find some place to do that privately. You don't want to be spanking your kid in the middle of corporate worship. You want to get them out of there. You don't want to do it at the dinner table at the restaurant, right? You want to go, to the bathroom or to your car or wherever you can that's secluded and administer discipline.
Yeah, two things related to that. One, don't forget that you're dealing with a little person who has their own dignity and their own honor and their own reputation in a way, right? And they're not a thing that you can do whatever you want with. They're a person. And so you actually have to steward their honor in a sense. You might be tempted to say, he forfeited his honor when he spilled the milk in that gloriously defiant fashion. Like, well, maybe, but still, right? And then second thing, if you see someone, if you see another dad who does this well, stick close to that guy. This is a mark of high virtue. If you can discipline your children well in public, just grab onto that guy's ankles and go whither he goest. it's a good mark of someone who is wise and mature and godly and will have things to teach you. So, yeah.
And it's particularly apt because it's a reflection not just that he knows some formula for good discipline, it's a reflection of his character and his self-control, because he is being very tempted right now, probably to lose his temper, to yell at his kid, whatever, to act out of his own shame in what the child has done. And yet he's totally keeping that under wraps and dying to it and crucifying it. And he's then treating his child like his child, right? Out of love and affection. And that shows such a maturity in the faith and a willingness to deal with his own sin. I think that's great advice. Like, find people. We have both known people and are striving to be dads that can model this, but we've latched onto them and learned from them, not just how to discipline in public, quote unquote, but how to be a godly man and rule my own spirit and have that kind of self-control. So that's great, great advice. The second thing that I think is just helpful from the outset to understand when thinking about principles for discipline on the go is that the best defense is a good offense, right? So if you're defending your child against their own sin and against temptation in their hearts, then you need to be attacking the temptations and the sins before they come. So this often, I think the simplest way with little kids to portray it is that this often looks like consistent reminders before something comes up. So Megan will do this with the kids where they're going to the grocery store or whatever it is. And we say, okay, or she says, these are the expectations for while we're in the store. Do this, not that. You guys know what's expected of you. You know what to do and what not to do. And there are simple things because these are toddlers, right? And we're going to be okay with them being a little louder than, you know, quietly at the dinner table in the parking lot, right? They can yell and sing and things like that. So you have to, again, be wise in those sorts of standards. Are you setting a list of 50 rules for them to abide by in the middle of Walmart? Or do you more or less have two or three things that are important and you focus on those things? And those are big enough things that keep them respectful of other people and, you know, with you so that they're not getting lost, those sorts of things. And the maybe corollary to that would be, we also do this with our kids when we go see family and they see cousins, right? And that's a big one because we're going to be spending 2 or 3 or 5 days together. And we want to help them understand, okay, these principles, first, your cousins are older than you. They get to do a lot of things that you don't get to do, and that's okay. And we're not going to complain about that when it happens, right? We're going to accept it and we'll have a good time together. And then there are these other things that, you know, their parents might address differently, and we're just not going to do it that way. And that's okay. Again, there are different standards, different stages of life, different kids, different families. And we're going to maintain our standards insofar as we can when we're with them. So we will, you know, head some of that temptation off at the pass by giving them a reminder, setting expectations that are clear, but not onerous for the stage of life that your kids are in.
That's exactly right. Could not agree more on all of that. I think this is a place where my wife shines. So Kelsey's great at this. She, has the rules of the store that are very simple. There's three of them. She made a little song, like, you know, rule number one, stay with mama. Rule number two, don't ask for anything. Rule number three, don't touch anything. I keep it simple. And obviously those are expanded now. The kids are a little bigger and can actually help with the shopping. Keep it simple, keep it clear, keep it attainable. All of that. She's also great whenever we're going over to anyone's houses and, helping me think about, okay, what are the temptations that our kids are going to have? How can we set them up for success? That's right. Best defense is a good offense. This is just an extension of all the work you've already done. In fact, this is kind of like game time. It's the same thing. And reminding your kids, like, this is, nothing is different as we're leaving the house. Same. It's just now we have slightly different circumstances, but we're going to apply the same things.
Really quickly, one thing to note here, and I have a question for you about it, is that in the grocery store in particular, it's maybe challenging. I alluded to this earlier a little bit, but like, you've got this cart full of things and you're in the middle of your shop and this kid is just defying you and just disobey, or maybe not even defying you, but look, again, you got to do yourself some favors here too. They disobeyed you when you really aren't, the behavior itself was not a problem, but you gave them a command and they clearly disobeyed. Like, okay, that's on you. You need to own that and maybe change it for next time. But the situation is still here. You've got to address it because this was clear disobedience. So it's not the same as something like a church or even a restaurant in some sense, because you can leave the restaurant and come back in pretty easily. You're not leaving this cart behind. Like, your meal is there and you're probably with other people that are going to be able to stay there, although maybe not always. Maybe it could be harder sometimes. What do you guys do typically, or do you know what Kelsey does, or how have you handled that? Do you typically go and like look for the bathroom in the store? Do you go out to the car? What's your typical go-to? Because that's a very practical thing that if you don't think about ahead of time, you're never going to be willing to administer discipline in the moment if you don't have a plan.
Yeah. So Kelsey will use the bathroom sometimes. Now, full disclosure, we discovered Walmart delivery and we've never looked back. So the times when Kelsey's actually in this, I'm just saying, right? We live in a fascinating modern age that's in weird ways like actually a throwback to the way things used to be when the grocer would deliver. Anyways, so I love it. No looking back. Some of the best money I've ever spent. So the circumstances where we are out with our kids grocery shopping are fairly minimal. But two pieces of advice there. One being, yeah, use the bathrooms, right? Bathrooms are great. And it's a pain, but hey, there you are. That's the way of it. And then secondly, there is a way to communicate, and I think this is appropriate. There is, you bring your kids into the grocery store, all of a sudden things are so exciting, they're seeing things, oh, well, all right. It can be very overstimulating. And I'm willing to give kids a little bit of latitude. We'll talk about this later, remembering their frame, but I'm willing to give kids some latitude for like the overstimulation and not crack down too hard initially. So what I will do if a child is being disobedient, difficult, defiant in the grocery store is, you know, we'll stop everything. I'll get the child. I will, you know, squat down, get on their level, and, you know, bring my full attention to bear on the child. Like, time stops. There is nothing in the world except for me and this little kid. And I will explain to them very clearly what they're doing that is wrong and how they need to fix it. And usually that is sufficient. And then we go back up and we're all right, and time restarts and the world is back. And then that's usually sufficient to curb their behavior and we don't need to deal with it. If it happens again, though, yeah. You ask one of the nice little clerks to keep your basket, and you trundle out of the car, you deal with it, and you come back. It's a pain, but the alternative is worse.
But just to kind of put a pin in it, the alternative is worse, right? It's painful for the moment, not just for them, but for you to have to interrupt everything. But in fact, maybe we'll just go there. We'll do these out of order in the way that I've listed them. But that's one of the key principles of discipline on the go, is that you've got to be willing to be interrupted in whatever you're doing. Your child's soul is more important than the groceries. It's more important than dinner with friends. It's more important than how things are going at work, if you happen to have your kids at work, right? They're more important. They're your primary responsibility in this life, and you're responsible for their souls. And God is going to hold you to account for how you walk with them and how you guide them and direct them to love His law. So that means, yeah, you've got to be willing to leave the store, leave the restaurant, whatever it is, find the bathrooms. If it's, you know, there are some stores that don't have public bathrooms. Okay, well, then go to the car, right? That's going to be even less convenient. Figure it out, because your child's soul is worth it. One of the things that I think is helpful just early on with kids is to set some standards for them in the car. If you're on a lengthier drive, like by lengthy, I mean like 10 to 15 minutes or more, not like an hour or 2 hours, because those don't happen very frequently. But if maybe a couple of times by the time your kid, maybe more if you need it, but by the time your kid is two or three, if a couple of times you have pulled over into a safe place and administered discipline in a parking lot somewhere, and like, don't just pull over on the side of the interstate for this. That's not safe. Like, please don't do that. To take an exit, get into a secluded place, like an empty parking lot or something, or just like a section of the parking lot further away from the storefront, right? Again, you don't want to be spanking your kid right outside of your car with 10 bystanders who don't understand or know the situation. You don't want to rob them of their dignity in that sense. So yeah, find that place, because what does that show them? It shows them we're on the way to church, or we're on the way to host people at home, and they're going to be waiting for us now, and we're going to be late because I disobeyed and Dad was still willing to stop and discipline me. And that just makes it a lot easier for car trips, right? If they know that you'll stop, and just because you can't reach them doesn't mean you won't be able to reach them in a few minutes, Again, it's just very helpful for them to understand I obey at all times, even when I'm out of arm's reach. And I know that dad can't just like stop whatever he's doing immediately. Teaching them that they are, again, they are important enough to delay your trip, to be late wherever you're going. It's just so, so important.
Yeah, dad pushed the nuclear button. We didn't think he would, but he did. And now they know you can push it whenever. Two things on that. One being, those are obviously times of higher stress. And so it is even easier to be angry, to be frustrated, to be impatient. So there is this mode of like, I'm going to pull over, we're going to spank that kid and get back on the road, and then I'm going to speed on the way home and snap at the wife. Like, okay, well.
That's all unhelpful, right? That all just made it 10 times worse. You would have been better to do nothing.
Yeah. And so maybe this is a good point to bring up. There is like a huge caveat to this that we've alluded to. And that is, like, you still never discipline in anger, which means if you can't get your spirit under control, then yeah, you do delay the discipline. Like, that's worse to discipline in anger, right? So try not to be there. But if you're aware of yourself, like, no, I actually, like, Lord help me, but I can't right now, then that's all right. It's not good, but get yourself under control. And there are things that are so important that it is worth delaying discipline for, and that is, you know, your own state of being. And then just like we've said again and again, as my dad would say, as pay me now or pay me later, right? You pull over now and you're paying 5 minutes, but if you don't address it, it'll be only worse later.
And two quick notes on both of those things separately. So first, just recognize as well, if you're angry enough that you can't discipline faithfully in the moment, that's something to work on for next time, right? Like, so delay the discipline as long as you need to and then come back to it. Don't forget about it. But you also need to search your own heart and seek the Lord in prayer, seek wisdom in His Word, seek wisdom from other dads, from your pastor, to figure out why is it that I take my own honor so seriously or my own inconvenience so seriously that I'm not willing to care for this immortal soul in the proper God-ordained way in the moment. And then, okay, switching gears to the second thing you said is you mentioned, right, 5 minutes now or a whole lot more pain later. That's also just very practical. Again, you make these things easier for yourself. That's why I said try to kind of build something in their lives early on, 2-3 years old, where you're stopping in a car and disciplining them, because that makes 5-hour trips in the car a lot smoother. When you know that 9 times out of 10, maybe 19 times out of 20, I can give my kids a command from the driver's seat and they're back all the way in the back of the van and they're going to obey and they're going to obey cheerfully and they're not going to fuss and complain. It might feel like I could never get there. If you're not there now, it might feel like I could never get there because of how crazy my kids are on long car rides. Well, just start with one thing, right? Like, choose one thing and really work at that thing meticulously with your kids and tell them that you're going to work on it together. Don't just spring it on them. Like, suddenly I can't yell when I've been yelling in the car for 4 years. And, you know, you talk about it with them and enforce it regularly and consistently, and you'll see it spill over into other areas too. Well, we got a couple more here that we can get to, and then we'll wrap up. So the next principle, I think, is that I came up with, at least, is in the words of the Boy Scouts of America or Scar from The Lion King, be prepared, right? So you prepare them, you remind them of expectations, but you also need to be prepared, which means, I think, primarily two things, particularly with young kids. Carry a spoon or whatever spanking implement that you use. And second, have a plan based on where you're going and what you're doing. And think about those things at least on the way. Don't think about those things when the discipline is coming up in the moment. Because then again, you're going to be flustered. The temptation is going to come. You don't really have a plan. What are you going to do? Do you have to address this thing? Was that really disobedience anyway? right? There are all kinds of compromises that come from not having a plan. But if you have a plan and you say, no, I know what we're going to do. Like, I'll leave the rest of the kids with Megan. I'll take this kid to the nearest bathroom at the zoo. We'll administer discipline, restore fellowship, and we'll come find you guys. It's fine. We have a meeting spot at the Lions or whatever, you know, and it's fine. So have a plan. Carry a spoon. I think I alluded to this when we were talking about having kids in worship, maybe. But I watched a dad walk by with a mixing spoon sticking out of the diaper bag and thought, I know what that's for. Respect.
Yeah. Open carry versus concealed carry. Yeah, varying schools of thought. Yeah, no, that's right. And communicate the plan to your wife as best you can. Yeah, no, that's right. If you what's the saying? If you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. You know what I mean.
If that's not the saying, it should be. If you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. That's good. So lastly here, this is something that does tie into the normal principles of discipline, but is particularly important, which is to remember their frame. Remember what age your kids are. I'm not going to expect the same thing of Levi, who is 4, that I do of Ezra, who's 2. It's going to be pretty close, but it's not the same. It's also not going to look anything like what I would expect from an 8-year-old, right? I say not anything like, you get what I mean there. Obviously, I expect both of them to be obedient and to be joyful in their obedience and those sorts of things. But the sort of self-control and the sort of engagement in whatever we're doing is going to look different for a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old in pretty dramatic ways. And so you need to just remember that. And like you said earlier, I like the kind of verbal getting down on their level, very intense moment of measured correction verbally can be enough sometimes to just make things click for a kid and help them understand what you, one note on that, just why that sort of communication in public is important is, again, remembering their frame. If you're just barking out commands as you walk through the grocery store pushing the cart or as you drive down the road without actually making eye contact and slowing them down, half the time, like if you're out doing something, they're not hearing you completely. And that's not even necessarily their fault. Like they're looking at the 10,000 boxes of Legos on the shelf and they literally don't process the command. And you're potentially disciplining them before the command is all the way out of your mouth, right? So those two things just aren't congruous. They don't go together.
Yeah. And also taking ownership for the times when you put them in circumstances that makes it particularly difficult for them to obey. You know, so you're going to grandma's house and you've, you know, been driving for 8 hours and it's 9:30 at night and everyone's tired and everyone's cranky and you get into grandma's house and then you got the unloading and you got, and then you tell, you know, Jimmy to put on his jammies and he just kind of flops over and doesn't put on his jammies. Like on the one hand, that's not okay. But on the other hand, that's actually probably fine. And, you know, for you to then bring the hammer down on him for failing to obey in that moment, at some point you say, like, actually, I put you in these circumstances that have made it very difficult for you to obey. So I'm going to remember your frame. Remember that you are but dust, as I am before my God. And you know, I'm going to put your jammies on for you, actually. And then we're going to get you into bed.
Yeah, I think in moments like that, there are varying responses that could do. You could discipline in the moment, depending on the context. Again, that might still be what's needed. And you discipline with some understanding there, right? You don't give the full amount of swats you might normally give or swats that are as hard or something like that. That could be a good opportunity to show them some grace in discipline and teach them about grace, and like you take them back and go through your normal routine. You walk them through repentance and restoration, but maybe you give them like a very light swat that's very obvious to them. This is not what it should have been. And you might even say to them in that moment, if you know I had an unreasonable demand, you could say to them, first, I want to show you some grace here and teach you about this concept. Second, I also want to acknowledge that it's very hard for you right now. And that doesn't mean that you don't need to repent and be reconciled, but it does mean that that's going to look a little bit different than if you were just high-handedly refusing. So that's one thing. The second thing is just to be very careful in those situations, what commands you're actually giving your kids. And sometimes I think we can slip into this mode of like, we just speak to our kids in commands, and that's not typically helpful. That's typically setting them up to disobey because, again, they're processing what we're saying when we're three sentences down and five more commands have come. And it's just not setting them up for success anytime, but particularly, you know, 8 hours in a car. My goodness. Let's slow things down. How about we just go put them in the pajamas without giving them that command? Like, just help them. Help them get to bed. It'll be faster anyway, and everybody will be at peace.
Everyone will be happier. No, that's right. That's right. I don't know. Maybe one or two concluding thoughts on my end. We've said it before, but it's worth repeating. This is all to give your heart rest, right? In the words of Proverbs, like, discipline your son when he is young, that he may give rest to your soul. Like, this is not intended, none of this is intended to be so that you're a totalitarian police state and everything has to be just so. No, this is for the sake of shalom. This is for the sake of peace and harmony and charity between all parties. And you have to maintain rigid standards for obedience and for respect and for submission when they're small, so that it can then be loosened and that they can then be in fellowship with you going forward. So, I don't know, we've been kind of harping on the maintaining the standards, holding the line, disciplining them, spanking, and that's right and good. I don't take any of it back, but it's all not for the end of having, you know, kids with sore bottoms, right? It's for the sake of having children who love their God and who are in fellowship with their parents and their siblings. It's for the sake of love to abound. And that has to be built on a foundation of obedience. And so we make a big deal of obedience, particularly when they're small. But I just got to say, my two oldest are 6 and 8, and it's already a different world than when they were toddlers. And, you know, some of these things, it's funny almost, some of these things feel like foreign concepts. Like, huh, weird. I guess I did used to do that with Benaiah and Rose. Huh. And I'm still definitely doing it with Peter and Sophie, so there's that. But it really does change. And if you're diligent at doing the work when they're really small, there's peace when they're bigger. Like, Rose beat me in Splendor the other day. I didn't think that was going to happen for a long time. But we were able to have fellowship over a board game, and it was absolutely delightful. Like me and Kelson, Benaiah and Rose played a four-way game, and Kels won. But Rose outscored me.
Maybe to paint a picture about what you're getting at here, you're doing these things for the sake of your Christmas dinner that's going to happen when your kids are all bringing their grandkids back, and you've got 30 children in the house around your dinner table, and you've got your adult children and their spouses around the dinner table, and that can go one of two ways. It can go a lot of ways, but, you know, on extremes, if everybody's there and present, it can be chaos and a nightmare, and you can't wait to get them out of the house because life can go back to peace between you and your wife, or it can be the thing that everyone looks forward to all year because it only happens once a year or once every other year or whatever it is. And they can't wait to come back and you can't wait for them to be there. As exhausted as you are, as wiped out as you are from having 30 people in your home or whatever it is, you know, you long for those moments because you were faithful with little and now they're being faithful, right? Now they're walking in faithfulness. And that's just something to strive for, to desire, and to pray for. That's parenting is not, we've said this before, but it's not like the sequence of buttons that you push on a calculator and then you hit the equal sign and everything just pops out. Parenting from beginning to end is by faith. And you trust the Lord to do the work through the effort that you give, right? You sow the seed, you water the seed, you trust Him to provide the growth. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean you can make the thing grow by your own efforts. And that doesn't mean that you don't have to plant and water and pull out weeds. It means you have to do that and you have to trust that God actually does want to use your efforts to bring fruit.
Yeah, that's right. You're the means that God has ordained in His grace to bring about His glory in the world. And we do that with fear and trepidation, but we also with faith that He will bring about His good purposes. No, that's right. And having the Christmas dinner in your mind, that's a good one. And anyone who is who has seen or known parents with wayward adult children, unimaginable heartache and headache. And so you're thinking, okay, here I've got these little guys, and it's a pain to discipline them. But if you are faithful with little, then they will give your soul rest. Well, I think that wraps up what I've got. Any objection to moving on to book recommendations?
I don't have any save rounds, so what's your book recommendation this week?
Today, I'm recommending Moby Dick by Herman Melville, which you get a lot of people hating on Moby Dick, but they're wrong, because it's wonderful. You don't read it for plot, but it's gargantuan, and it's wonderful, and it's all about man and his quest for God and his rebellion against God and God's sovereignty. And you know, spoiler alert, you know, the white whale is Calvinism, and that's just the way of it. So you should go into it like I did, just assuming that it would be an encyclopedia about whaling. And then if there was any elements that were not an encyclopedia about whaling, you're pleasantly surprised. Now, I maybe was an easy sell because I actually find whaling and all of that utterly fascinating on a number of levels. So I was an easy sell. But it is truly, truly a awe-inspiring book. I recommend it very highly. Moby Dick, Herman Melville.
Not at the top of my list, but it is on my list. We didn't have to read it in school, and I wish we did because I want to have read it. It's like a classic is the book that nobody wants to read, but everybody wants to have read. I don't actually hold to that view, but that is kind of how I've thought about Moby Dick particularly. And I've become more fascinated. I watched a documentary about all these documentaries about whales in the ocean that we keep bringing up, but about the story that inspired Moby Dick of the ship that got attacked by the whale, and man, horrible, absolutely gut-wrenching. So anyway, that got me more interested, and maybe I bumped this up the list a couple spots, not maybe in the top 10, but still pretty close. So my book this week is The Bitcoin Standard by, and sit a little loose in the saddle with me here, Saifedean Ammous, I think. But if you just look up The Bitcoin Standard, you'll find it. So this is basically a book that explains what Bitcoin is and isn't. And I found it very helpful. First, just in understanding basic economic principles. He's very rock solid on the basics of what an economy is, what money is versus currency, how to store value and in your wealth and things like that, why people actually agree on something like gold or whatever they choose to use as a store of value. And then he obviously, I think, makes a case for Bitcoin being the way of the future and something that is worthwhile to store your wealth in. He, I think, helpfully distinguishes Bitcoin in many ways from cryptocurrency, which I would hold to as well, but we can't go into now. But those are different things. People lump them into the same category. But there's some fundamental distinctions between Bitcoin and everything else that are very important from an economic perspective and also maybe from a philosophical perspective as well. But then lastly, this would be like my pitch for Bitcoin in general. This is always what I tell people. Not that I have any. All of my Bitcoin I lost in a boating accident, so don't come looking. It's gone forever at the bottom of the lake. That's how it works, and I'm sticking to it. So the pitch that I give people is Bitcoin is often kind of ridiculed maybe as a get-rich-quick scheme, which some people do treat it that way, and they get burned, and they get what they deserve. It shouldn't be viewed that way, though. It should be viewed more as a don't-go-broke-slowly scheme. Right? Like you want your dollars to maintain their value or maybe grow in value over time, but they're not doing that if they're in a bank. Like just the interest that you make on a savings account does not track with inflation. You're losing spending power every year if your money's in the bank. So that was a helpful concept for me, really fundamentally changed the way that I look at money in some important ways. And I think some biblical ways. The guy's not a believer, but I think he's drawing on good biblical principles of economics, just in terms of how he explains things. So yeah, The Bitcoin Standard, great book, pretty easy to read, fascinating, even if you decide, I don't want anything to do with that. It seems like a crazy person's game. That's fine. But still a fun and interesting read.
Yeah, sounds good. My interest is piqued.
All right, well, that's about all the time we have for today. So if you've enjoyed the show, Feel free to check out our Substack. You can see a link to that in the description. You can also, and this is new, we haven't talked about this in person yet, you can find a link to our Patreon in the description below. So we've started a Patreon if you want to support the show. That's a way that you can kind of help us pay the bills behind the scenes for hosting and editing and things like that longer term. So we'd love to have your support if the show has been helpful for you. And if you have anything to spare, even something like $5 a month goes a long way to covering those costs. So thank you for any of you who do end up deciding to support the show in that way. We also want to say thank you to Shane Caver for the use of our theme music. And thank you to ETC Media for partnering with us and editing the podcast. They've been great to us, and you can find a link to their website in the description as well. With that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty. Shoot. I'm going to start it again. I lost my train of thought. I was going to introduce you. I've already done the Man of the Hour, the Tower of Power.
Yeah, you already did that one.
Okay. Well, that's right.